Inside of Sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Today is Tuesday, November 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinny Ruoffo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, China and Russia push for an end to sanctions on North Korea.
China and Russia signed on to those United Nations Security Council resolutions, to those sanctions over the past 5-10 years, something like that.
The UN ramps up effort to de-escalate violence in Ethiopia as battle for the capital looms.
Everybody is really concerned, from the Secretary General to the UN Humanitarian Aid Chief to the Security Council.
And the World Health Organization and the UN kick off polio vaccination campaign in Afghanistan. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. China and Russia are urging the UN Security Council to end a host of sanctions against North Korea, including a ban on exports of seafood and textiles, a cap on imports of refined products, and a prohibition of its citizens working overseas and sending home their earnings. A draft resolution circulated to council members stresses the economic difficulties in North Korea and says the sanctions should be lifted to promote the livelihoods of civilians. A similar China-Russia draft in 2019 drew strong Western opposition, and diplomats say opposition is also likely for this one. This, as South Korea called for an end of its war with the North that has technically lasted for decades. For more, I spoke with VOA Seoul Bureau Chief Bill Gallo.
The only side that's really pushing hard for this is South Korea, which is a problem. As you mentioned, we really haven't heard anything from North Korea regarding the end of war declaration. About a month or two ago, they said they were open to it, but then other voices in North Korean state media also said it really doesn't make much sense to do just completely out of context. If you remember, the end of war declaration was being considered very seriously during the second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. It was thought that this would sort of be part of a wider agreement that was signed at the Hanoi summit. But whenever that ended early and there was nothing signed, basically this has gone on the back burner. The thought is that an end of war declaration, among those who support it, the thought is that an end of war declaration could help sort of spur progress. That it really doesn't mean anything necessarily on paper, but that it's sort of something to build momentum. The problem is, if North Korea doesn't want it, and if North Korea doesn't get anything else besides the end of war declaration, it's not really clear how it could build any momentum for peace talks. However, there are serious people who do believe this. This peace talk situation has been stalled for so long that we really need something, anything, to sort of move the process forward.
For a war that technically been going on, if you want to use that expression, for decades, how are the people reacting to this new push to formally end it?
Well, in South Korea, efforts like this are quite popular, partly because it's low risk. So you see here in South Korea that the majority of citizens are very highly supportive of initiatives meant to reach out to North Korea. However, as far as the end of war declaration, I haven't really seen any specific polling on South Korean support for that. I suspect it would be quite high. However, there are concerns that if you do sort of formalize the end of the war, and it's not clear how such a declaration would be phrased and what it would actually do, which is part of the problem. But if you sort of formalize the end of war, there are concerns here among some people that it could sort of jeopardize the presence, the long-term presence of the U.S. military, which is still, you know, there's 30,000 troops almost here, U.S. troops in South Korea, and that presence is very popular. It's protected South Korea, as you mentioned, for many decades now, without major hostilities.
Why is Russia and China pushing so hard for the end of sanctions on North Korea when almost all countries in the world are using that as some kind of a state to keep North Korea from going ahead to further develop its nuclear weapons?
Well, it's really interesting, right? Because China and Russia signed on to those United Nations Security Council resolutions, to those sanctions over the past, what, maybe 5-10 years, something like that? So now you're starting to see a more concerted push by both of those countries to relax those sanctions. In their opinion, in China and Russia's opinion, North Korea deserves some sanctions relief because of the fact that they have not tested nuclear weapons or any long-range ballistic missiles for quite some time. It's been since 2017. They've taken a 4-year break. Of course, they've tested all kinds of other missiles. They continue to nuclear production of materials and things like that. That's never stopped.
That's VOA's Bill Gallo speaking with me from Seoul. Workplace mandates requiring vaccination against COVID-19 continue to be controversial in the U.S. The Biden administration is expected to respond this week to a recent federal court decision to temporarily halt federal vaccine mandate rules for large employers. Michelle Quinn reports.
Around the U.S., the fight over workplace rules requiring vaccination against COVID-19 is heating up. The White House is set to respond this week to a court order temporarily halting a federal vaccine mandate for businesses with more than 100 employees. Some states, businesses, and religious groups sued, arguing the mandate is unconstitutional. The Biden administration argues it is necessary. Dr. Vivek Murthy is the U.S. Surgeon General. He spoke on ABC this week.
There are times where we recognize that our decisions have a broader effect on people around us. COVID has reminded us of that. And that's why having these types of requirements in workplaces will be not only helpful, but it's a necessary step to accelerate our pathway out of the pandemic.
The Biden administration says it's the responsibility of the federal government to create and enforce workplace safety rules. But some lawmakers say the COVID-19 mandate goes too far. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is a Republican. He spoke out against the federal rules.
I don't think people want this decision yanked away from them. I don't think they want to allow a precedent where the federal government could come in and just force you to do what it wants you to do.
With more people signing up to get a shot every day, some question whether the federal rules, which will go into effect in January, are worth the struggle. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, spoke on CBS Face the Nation.
We need to ask ourselves, what is our goal? We vaccinated about 81% of adults over the age of 18. Where do we need to get to, and what price are we willing to pay in terms of cultural divide, acrimony, challenges?
While the number of new COVID-19 cases continues to decline in the U.S., an additional 70,000 cases are being recorded every day. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
At a news conference, White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said vaccination requirements can stand up to legal scrutiny.
The Congress empowered OSHA through a law that has been in the books for more than 50 years. So this is an authority that we believe that the Department of Labor has. We are very confident about it.
That's White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. Veterans Day, which initially marked the armistice that ended World War I in 1918, is a federal holiday observed every November 11th, honoring U.S. military veterans for their service to the nation. This Veterans Day marks the first since the end of the war in Afghanistan, a conflict in which more than 750,000 U.S. forces served and more than 2,400 never returned home. VOA's Ken Farabaugh spoke with one mother who reflects on America's longest war and her son's sacrifice.
Denise Williams is a regular visitor to the Middle East Conflict's Memorial Wall along the banks of the Illinois River near Marseilles, Illinois.
This memorial represents those who have died since 1967 in all Middle East conflicts. People forget we lost three soldiers in the Yom Kippur War in 1967. The infamous Black Hawk Down, Mogadishu, they're here. USS Cole, they're here. So it's not just post 9/11 here. It's all Middle East conflicts.
But there is one name on these walls closest to Williams' heart, her sons, Andrew Meary.
This is not a legacy and a reminder of death to me. This is a reminder to the living that everything you have was purchased with these names, with these lives. It is something to remember, something to honor, to appreciate.
Private First Class Andrew Meary was deployed with the Army's 101st Airborne Division in southern Afghanistan during the U.S. troop surge in 2010, when a suicide bomber on a motorcycle detonated a device near his outpost. One of the soldiers with Meary that day, Sergeant Felipe Pereira, later recalled the incident in a video produced by the U.S. Defense Department.
I run down the hill even further. That's when I got to PFC Meary, and you know, the soldier just turns up to me, you know, Specialist Thorne just turns up to me and says, man, he's dead. He's gone.
Andrew Meary was just 21 years old when he was laid to rest on Veterans Day, November 11th, 2010, near his home in Illinois. His is now one of more than 2,400 names on these panels who died serving in the U.S. military in Afghanistan since 2001. Miri visited his mother on leave just weeks before he died. Williams says even then, he never wavered in his understanding of the mission to eliminate terrorist threats in the country.
He absolutely believed if we were not fighting them there, we would be fighting them here. He believed in what he was doing. He believed in the righteousness of it.
Williams views that objective in Afghanistan as a success. Osama bin Laden was captured and killed less than a year after her son's death.
Everything else that we did in Afghanistan, while there's many noble causes, and there's many noble ideas, that's not what a war is about. That's not what soldiers are for. Soldiers don't dig wells and build schools. And my son participated in some of that. That's not the purpose of soldiers.
Today, Williams represents Illinois Gold Star Mothers as the nonprofit service organization's president.
We are the mothers of those who have lost their child or children because of their decision to put on this nation's uniform.
As the United States marks the first November 11th Veterans Day after the end of the war in Afghanistan, a date which also marks exactly 11 years since she buried her son, Williams answers a difficult question she is often asked.
I get asked, well, was it worth it? There is no such thing as their child's death being worth it to a mother's heart. Period. But my son didn't fight for the Afghan people. He did not fight for a political party. He did not fight for anything other than the Constitution, the oath that he swore. He fought for the American people, for America. America's worth fighting for.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Marseilles, Illinois.
UN officials were briefed Monday on the violence in Ethiopia, days after Tigrayan forces began marching towards the capital with the intention of convincing Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to step down a year after he began a military campaign in the Tigray region. VOA's United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir tells VOA's Carol Van Dam UN officials are deeply concerned the situation will soon be out of control in Ethiopia.
Everybody is really concerned, from the Secretary General to the UN humanitarian aid chief to the Security Council, which on Friday finally broke basically a six-month silence to actually call for an end to the hostilities. So now we see a lot of unity in the Security Council as things are escalating that they want it to stop. And Martin Griffiths, who's the UN humanitarian chief, he is wrapping up a four-day visit to Ethiopia today. He's in Mekelle, the capital of Tigray province, on Sunday, and he met Friday with Prime Minister Abiy and with the Deputy Prime Minister/Foreign Minister, who he met with again today. He met with the Deputy Prime Minister/Foreign Minister again today. So the real goal for the UN, it's two parts: stop the fighting, get the aid in, because there is, in just northern Ethiopia, there are 7 million people who really are in dire need of medical assistance and food. And so they need to get that in. Ethiopia-wide, there are 20 million people who need humanitarian assistance. So the UN already has a huge concern about this country. But if you're going to add an internal armed conflict to it, it's going to get exponentially worse. And I think everyone at the UN is really concerned about that.
As with the whole world, it seems, you know, the African Union folks and other regional partners and the U.S., everyone seems very concerned that the march that's been happening the last couple of days of the Tigrayan forces toward the capital could even amp things up even much, much worse. So do you know if the U.N. has been talking, the U.N. Security Council in particular, been talking about a plan in place, some kind of a plan B to try to stop it from escalating?
The African Union is in the lead on the mediation for the whole situation in northern Ethiopia. The African Union likes to say there needs to be African solutions to African problems. And so this is a case study in that. So the AU has actually been quite aggressive in trying to get this under control. They've appointed a mediator or an envoy for the Horn of Africa, the former Nigerian president, Olusegun Obasanjo, and he's going to brief the UN Security Council on his latest efforts. So basically the UN sort of has to take their lead from the AU. You know, nobody wants to step on anybody's toes in terms of who should be in the lead. So the African Union is stepping up, and the UN is coming in behind them and supporting
supporting them, and now you also have the support of the UN Security Council. And when there is unified support in the UN Security Council, things work much better than when you have a split among particularly the five permanent members, meaning the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, because if they're unified, then there can be action.
That's VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam about efforts to de-escalate the violence in Ethiopia. The World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Agency kicked off a polio vaccination campaign in Afghanistan on Monday, the first nationwide campaign to fight the disease in 3 years. Lucy Field of Reuters reports.
A polio vaccination campaign kicked off in Afghanistan on Monday, the first in 3 years. The campaign, run by the World Health Organization and UNICEF, aims to reach over 3 million children. The WHO said it had received Taliban backing, which would allow teams to reach children in previously inaccessible parts of the country. But hurdles remain. Trained staff are in short supply. Polio vaccinator Hasibullah Kaderi says resistance from families is another challenge.
We didn't receive the polio medicines on time, and most of the families refused to vaccinate their kids because there were rumors that this polio vaccine may harm their children. These are the issues we're facing.
Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan are the last countries in the world with endemic polio, an incurable and highly infectious disease transmitted through sewage. It can cause crippling paralysis in young children. Polio has been almost eradicated globally through a decades-long inoculation drive. But insecurity, inaccessible terrain, mass displacement, and suspicion of outside interference have hampered mass vaccination in both countries. Several polio workers were killed by gunmen in eastern Afghanistan this year, though it was not clear who was behind the attacks. According to WHO figures compiled before the collapse of the Western-backed government in August, there was one reported case of wild polio virus type 1 in Afghanistan in 2021, compared with 56 in 2020.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. A study by Monash University researchers in Australia has found that moderate drinking of alcohol is associated with a reduced risk of cardiovascular diseases and a lowering of deaths from all causes when compared to zero alcohol consumption. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
More than 18,000 people over the age of 70 in the United States and Australia took part in the research. It's the first study to investigate the heart health implications of drinking alcohol. It found that the consumption of modest amounts of alcohol was associated with a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. Robin Woods is an associate professor in the School of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Monash University.
Taking or consuming 5 to 10 alcoholic beverages a week, which is quite modest, gave better outcomes than those who were completely teetotal. It seemed to be associated with a reduced cardiovascular disease risk and also of all-cause mortality.
Researchers have said their findings should be interpreted with caution because participants in the study were healthy with no previous heart or other severe diseases. They could also have been more physically and socially active than the wider aging population. Exactly how modest alcohol consumption can reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and other causes of death is unknown. Associate Professor Wood says more research is needed.
There is some evidence that modest alcohol intake has vascular properties that could be beneficial, but there's also the potential for social benefits. So, you know, consuming alcohol with friends, family, etc., may well have a benefit.
The Monash University Melbourne research is published in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. Guidelines from the Australian Drug and Alcohol Foundation, a leading public health organisation, advise that both men and women should consume no more than 10 standard drinks per week. A standard drink in Australia contains 10 grams of alcohol. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This week, officials at COP26 will address the transition to electric cars and how this can offset climate change. Most of the electric cars on the market get their cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo, where workers are exploited with low wages, violent abuse, and more, according to a new report out this week by the group called RAID, or Rights and Accountability in Government. The group's executive director, Anneke van Woudenberg, spoke to Ricky Shryock about the revelations they found in their research and the actions they need to be taking to ensure a green revolution does not mean disenfranchising DRC residents.
What's interesting about our findings is that this isn't artisanal mining, which has been in the news a lot lately. This is at large-scale industrial cobalt mines, which really provide the bulk of the cobalt that goes into the rechargeable batteries on electric vehicles. And what we found were really dire conditions, including extremely low pay for the workers, excessive working hours, degrading treatment, violent discrimination, racism. I mean, really a wake-up call for any of the electric vehicle manufacturers like Tesla or General Motors or others who are building the electric vehicles for our green energy revolution. They need to check their supply chains and really make sure that the cobalt we're getting is clean and free from human rights abuses. And our research shows that certainly today is not the case.
Can you tell me more specifics about, for example, the extremely low pay?
So at the heart of the problem we found was a system of subcontracting companies. So in effect, thousands of these workers, and remember, these big mines employ tens of thousands of Congolese workers. They're not hired directly by the mine, but in fact, they're hired indirectly via labor agencies and subcontracting companies. And it's these companies that really are not providing healthcare benefits, that are paying them an absolute pittance, sometimes $80 a month, sometimes even less, which works out to just under a few dollars a day. And look, that's in sharp contrast to, of course, the huge profits that mining companies are making, and of course, the boom that we're going to see in electric vehicles, which will make many of these manufacturers a hefty sum of money, not least Tesla. Look, the other thing that we found was that some of the treatment of workers was just shocking, from being beaten, slapped, insulted at, pulled around by their ears, kicked, you know, hit with shovels, brooms, canes. Look, I think this is a big issue for COP26 to look at this week, and they're due to talk about transportation on Wednesday, in particular this week. Switch to electric vehicles away from the internal combustion engine. And I think the reality of this for all of us is anyone buying an electric vehicle is likely to be linked to cobalt coming from Congo and therefore to this worker exploitation. We need a just transition away from the fossil fuel economy.
That's Anneke van Woudenberg, the executive director of the group Rights and Accountability in Government, or RAID. She was speaking with Ricky Schreier from London. In other news, former U.S. President Barack Obama is expressing confidence that the Biden administration will ultimately get its $555 billion climate package through Congress, and says the bill will be, quote, historic, unquote. At the U.N. climate talks Monday, he also faulted U.S. rivals China and Russia for what he called a, quote, dangerous lack of urgency, unquote, in cutting their climate-wrecking emissions. The former U.S. president is visiting the summit to urge nations to act faster and harder in cutting emissions and coping with the mounting damage from climate change. Obama says, quote, all of us have sacrifices to make, unquote, on climate, but he says rich nations have an extra burden. He also encouraged both Democrats and Republicans to work together on climate issues because he says nature does not care about party affiliation. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor. Pakistan is one of the most vulnerable countries to climate change in the world. In order to defend against the destructive effects of the warming planet, the government plans to plant 10 billion trees by 2023. Shazib Jalani reports from District Manshara in North Pakistan.
Meet Asia Bibi, a mother of five. She, along with other family members, has been running this nursery in her backyard for 6 years. The project is part of the government's Green and Clean Pakistan campaign to plant more trees.
This is a lot of hard work, along with running the household and taking care of children. I attend to the seedlings a couple of hours in the morning and then in the afternoon every day. The challenge is to ensure they take root and do not die out.
Under the government signature 10 billion tree project, the provincial forest department pays for the initial costs of the saplings. Months later, the plants are bought back by the government for reforestation. The income goes a long way to help Asia take care of her large family. As a result, Pakistan's forest cover has increased significantly. More than 3 billion trees have already been planted in the last 8 years, say officials. Launched on a provincial level after 2013, the Billion Tree Project expanded at a national level in 2018 because it was seen as a success, including in District Mansehra. However, illegal logging remains a big problem, along with forest fires and animal grazing. Under its Green Jobs initiative, thousands of forest guards have been hired from the community to protect the trees.
Many of these plants are very young. They are constantly under threat. We keep an eye on their survival and report any violations to the forest department.
But the project has not been without criticism. Political opponents have raised questions over transparency and accountability. Others have accused the government of mismanaging the plantation drive in early years and introducing exotic invasive species ill-suited for the region. Not so, says the man leading this initiative launched by the Prime Minister, Imran Khan.
Well, 60% of this project, even today, is assisted natural regeneration. There's no chance of going and planting an invasive species over there. So it's just nature coming back with its own plants through its own process, but you are protecting it in an organized manner, and that's how it happens.
Most experts agree that despite initial obstacles, the country has shown a rare commitment to restore and expand its otherwise shrinking forest cover.
And yes, they achieved it. And I think the what is happening now is donors are looking in how they can build on that plantation, on that forestry, and bring benefits back to the community, back to the forest department, back to Pakistan.
Back at the village, Asia Bibi is telling her daughters about the livestock she was able to buy from her nursery earnings. The family can only hope that the initiative will help lead to a greener, better tomorrow for future generations. Shazib Jilani, VOA News, District Mansehra.
This is Science in a Minute.
The LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration has released what they are calling the largest data catalog of gravitational wave detections. Gravitational waves travel at the speed of light and are described as ripples in the fabric of space-time. According to a press release from the scientific partnership, the new catalog includes data on 35 gravitational wave detections made at their observatories in the U.S. states of Louisiana and Washington and in Italy during its third and latest observing run from November 2019 to March 2020. 32 of the 35 gravitational wave detections were made by the mergers of various sized black holes. Two are the result of a black hole merging with a neutron star, and one of the events was produced by a black hole merging with either a neutron star or a very light black hole. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Ruoff in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Peace.
is the voice of America. Washington!